It was the dawn of the third age of podcasting, 30 years after the series had launched.
The Babylon Podcast was a dream given form. Its goal, to discuss the place where humans and aliens could work out their differences peacefully.
It's a port of call, home away from home for established fans, newbies, John, Blaine, and guests.
Humans and aliens wrapped in 2,500,000 tons of spinning metal, all alone in the night.
It could be a dangerous place.
Wait, what?
But it's our last, best hope for peace.
This is the story of the last of the Babylon stations.
The year is 2024.
The name of the podcast is...
Babylon 5, 30 years later. Welcome to the latest episode of Babylon 5, 30 years later, where John Wilson and I, Blaine Dowler, go through every episode of Babylon 5, as well as the spin-off Crusade and the made-for-TV movies, and with only three exceptions, we cover them 30 years after the original broadcast or release date. So, how are you doing, John?
I'm doing all right. I wasn't sure if I should jump in there and say hi or not, but yes, I am here. I was walking over to the recording studio and was accosted in the hallways. People told me I looked like this mass murderer from 30 years ago, and I'm like, I was only a kid 30 years ago. Who knows how many people I murdered?
Yeah. Yeah, I gotta love it when that happens.
Yeah, it's just, you know, day in the life, I guess. But I'm excited to talk about Deathwalker today.
Yes, Deathwalker originally aired April 20th, 1994. Directed by Bruce Seth Green and written by Lawrence DiTillo. Now, that was based on concepts from the list that were offered by Jim Michael Straczynski. He had some ideas. So Straczynski's ideas for this episode that DiTillo grabbed were an A-plot. And the idea was, if Hitler was alive today, what would it take to avoid prosecution? That was the original concept. So DiTillo said, well, let's first off make this, you know, genderless Hitler character in the idea page into a female, because the tyrants are usually male. So just to change that up a bit. And... you know, he says, well, yeah, let's make it an immortality serum that can be offered to, you know, highest bidder or to different species so that they will see the value. The B plot was one in which Tally Winters is hired by Kosh for negotiations with someone who has no thoughts at all. And the whole conversation is a series of riddles, and Talia gets increasingly uncomfortable as things go on. The A plot is the one with the Hitler-like character. She is the last of the Dilgar. So the Dilgar were a species that were exterminating others. So before Earth got involved in the Minbari War, or before they went to war with the Minbari, Earth chose to ally themselves against the Dilgar in that war to prevent the extermination, and they are the ones that turned the tide.
And who better to get as an actress for that character than one of the conquering Kryptonians from Superman 2? So Sarah Douglas as Ursa in that movie and as Deathwalker in this movie.
Yeah, there were... they were really trying for two major stars in this one, and they almost had both. And that's on top of returning Robin Curtis, who was the second Savik in the Star Trek movies, and here plays Ambassador Kalika, friend of the League of Non-Aligned Worlds that discovered Deathwalker is on the station and not being brought to trial. The other major star that they wanted to get, who had to back out last minute due to schedule conflicts, was Gilbert Gottfried, who was going to fly out from New York to play Abbott, who was the character that Kosh was negotiating with.
Okay. That would have been really interesting. I have things to say about that storyline, but yeah, getting Gilbert Gottfried to that role would have been an interesting move.
Yeah, and it was played by Cozy Costa, who was a comedian and an actor. I don't know that I've ever seen him in anything else. His IMDb profile is sparse enough that he doesn't even have a picture. And out of his 26 credits, this is number 24. So, okay, it looks like I might have seen him. He had guest stars in, or guest appearances in Different Strokes and Galactica 1980 and Life Goes On, all three of which were shows that I watched inconsistently.
Mm-hmm. Well, 1994, Gilbert Gottfried would have been doing stuff like voicing Aladdin, voicing Iago for the Aladdin sequel, or... lots of little roles here and there, because Gilbert Gottfried is one of those faces that showed up everywhere, so I can see how he would have been too busy for this.
Yeah. I think my personal favorite Gilbert Gottfried role, bringing it back to Superman once again, is Mr. Mixis Pytlick in the animated series.
Oh, yes. I do love his portrayal there. He also shows up in the Superboy TV show. It's one of his early credits. He plays this childlike character. Gilbert Gottfried doesn't always come off on screen, but he's kind of a diminutive person physically. And he plays this, like, adult child kind of super villain character in that show. But speaking of Mixis Pytlick and Superboy together, that is one of my least favorite Mixis Pytlicks in all of the Mixis Pytlicks. But anyways. But yeah, so Cozy Costa, he doesn't have nearly as many credits, but he did the part.
Yeah, this is one where Larry DeTillio was a little disappointed with how it turned out, because in both cases, the people did well. Cozy Costa just wasn't Gilbert Gottfried.
Mm-hmm.
And when you watch it, knowing it was intended for Gilbert Gottfried, you could see how it would have played differently. His other regret is that he called for the wolf-like eyes and the contact lenses for Sarah Douglas, which in later commentaries he said that was his greatest regret of the series, was covering her amazing eyes, especially since those lenses were important enough that it impacted her performance, which I would not have guessed. I don't see flaws in this performance, but apparently how she was doing in rehearsals and in the auditions, it was stronger than what she did in the finished product because of those contact lenses.
And I found the contact lenses rather startling. I liked the eyes and I loved her performance. So I can see how an artist might be like, yeah, but it wasn't this. But as just somebody who's watching it, I thought it was rather effective.
Yeah, I did like the look. It's one of the criticisms of other sci-fi franchises is that all the eyes are human.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And part of that is because there's so much acting around the eyes. And that's something that they even did here to a degree. So when they were talking with Optic Nerve, who does the prosthetic alien makeup, they need to know, is this going to be, you know, a major speaking role or not? So Ambassador Kalika's makeup is going to have more flexibility around the eyes and mouth so that the actor can emote through them than the headpiece of someone who's just sitting in the background and never talking.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, these culminate, or both of these plots. The A-plot culminates where they finally strike out a deal where, yes, Deathwalker will have her trial postponed until after she has helped the League of Non-Aligned Worlds and Earth Alliance work together to develop the serum that would be shared and made available to all. Although she says, reveals only at the last second, that one of the ingredients cannot be synthesized. So in order for one person to live forever, someone else is going to have to die. And as she is being escorted off the station to Earth, a Vorlon cruiser comes out of the jump gate and destroys the ship, blowing it out of the sky. And Kosh, who showed up to observe, which is very unusual for Kosh, just says, "You are not ready for immortality," and leaves.
It would have felt more unusual for Kosh if he hadn't been in so much of the episode. But that scene, feeling completely disconnected from everything else he did in the episode, felt less momentous and more just kind of weird.
Yeah, I can imagine that. But yes, he was, as you said, a heavy part of the B plot. He probably has more dialogue in this episode than he does in the rest of the season.
Probably combined to this point.
Yeah, because of the B plot. And that B plot, when it wraps up, the negotiations are done. Talia is extremely uncomfortable to the point that she's tried to quit because she keeps having flashes of terrifying images. When she's done, Abbott tips his hat to sort of say goodbye, and we see an exposed brain with electronics wired to it. And then when Talia afterwards goes to Sinclair and Garibaldi to say, "I think I may have a problem with Kosh," Garibaldi recognizes Abbott as she describes him. He's a vicar, meaning he can record it. So the purpose of this negotiation was not to negotiate anything. It was for Kosh to have a record of what's going on inside Talia's head.
And just because the word has meaning as a homophone, we're not talking vicar like a representative of a faith. The vicar is a pronunciation of VCR as an old recording device.
Yeah, and Larry DeTillio says it was probably a good thing that the series was on at that time, because otherwise he might have been a David.
I like that. Yeah, as soon as they said vicar, it stands for VCR, I was like, oh yeah, this was made in 1994, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's one part that doesn't quite ring true. Yeah, referencing old Earth tech, that's fine. But it's 2022, and I've got high school students who don't know what a VCR is.
Right.
So, not all of them. I'd say when it came up in class, it was about 50-50 for who knew and who didn't.
Yeah. Well, we have synonyms. We have recording this, and we have taping this. And taping something, people still say it, but it no longer has meaning. And kids are like, taping? What is that?
Yeah. Same like the, I haven't heard it live, but I've seen the things online where you have kids saying, oh, you 3D printed the save icon.
Mm-hmm.
When they see one of the old 3.5-inch floppy disks.
Yeah, what is that blue square save icon anyway? Yep, exactly.
All right, so I think that wraps up so that the key points of the plot. So the writer, director, we've heard both Larry DiTillo and Bruce Seth Green before. So.
This was an interesting way to come back from a break. We are also coming back from a break. We were here last week to talk about feedback, probably. And we are coming into the second of three segments for this season. And I thought this is a pretty strong return.
Yeah, it does work out well. Actually, I think one point I left out in the A-plot summary is that this kicks off when Natoff, who is at the bay waiting for a Narn delegate, recognizes Deathwalker and attacks her with a Shankar, which is a blood oath, because her grandfather and a lot of that, the people in that immediate family, were experimented on by Deathwalker. So she has sworn a blood oath to destroy her, and she ended up disrupting things because that Narn ambassador she was there to meet was supposed to make contact with Deathwalker and start the negotiations for that immortality serum.
There are definitely two different responses to that based on if you've seen this episode or not, because for the first act or so, the identity of the Deathwalker character is a question mark. You know, Natoth is accusing her of being Deathwalker. No one even knows what Deathwalker looks like, except for in records that I had to go look up. And just whether or not this woman is even she has to be determined. Then watching it a second time, it's just like, oh, yeah, that's definitely, like you said, a Hitler analog walking out in public on a station, getting attacked by, you know, a survivor of the war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you're right. It is an interesting way to kick it off. And part of that is because there is an action sequence in that pre-credits teaser where, you know, first Tali is hired by Kosh, and then the second half of the pre-credits teaser is when Natoth recognizes Deathwalker and attacks her very, very ferociously. And that's part of how they convince people that her immortality serum might actually work, her anti-agapic, is because of how easily she's recovering from the attack. So she is healing up very nicely, and people are going, how could she be this character, this person who was doing this 30 years ago? She should be an old woman now. Mm-hmm. So that, plus Franklin's analysis of the serum, that confirms it's probably going to do she claims it can do, but they would need her help to understand it well enough to synthesize it.
So I realize that not everybody has linguistics brain. Whenever they said anti-agapic the first time, the little person inside my head says, agapic, let's see, A-G at the beginning of that. Could it just be anti-aging? Is she developing some sort of anti-aging process? And so the Garibaldi's like, an anti-whatic? And then they talk about, yes, she's developed an anti-aging serum. And I'm like, oh yes, I got it. But Garibaldi and I had very different reactions to that.
Yeah. And this was something that DiTillo said, okay, I need an immortality serum, but he describes himself as a science defective. So he called a doctor friend and said, okay, what could she have made? And his doctor said, she made an anti-agapic. And he went, great, sounds good, I trust you, and thus ended his research.
Well, it was enough. You know, sometimes a little bit of research isn't enough, and this one it was.
Yeah, because this is about the ethics of the decisions being made. This is not about the science of the serum.
No.
So having a label and having people say, yeah, it will probably do what it needs to do, but we need her to make more. That's all that needs to be established to keep this plot going forward.
Mm-hmm. There was a, I forget the species name, that Londo's girlfriend was from. They have the famously bald women. There was one walking by in that opening scene.
Centauri?
Yeah. Are the Centauri women bald? I thought she was from another species. No, she was Centauri.
Centauri
right.
Women are bald.
I'm sorry. You are totally correct. My brain's freaking on that. So there was a Centauri woman in the opening scene. And pretty sure that was natural baldness, because it looked like she had, like, you know, hair follicles showing through, making the scalp look just a little bit grayish. And I don't know if the woman just, you know, naturally chooses to walk around bald, or if she shaved her head for that scene. Either way, I was impressed.
I know that Jim S. said, for all the Centauri women in the course of the series, there is only one who actually was bald. Everybody else had skin caps. And he would not say who it was, but he did find it amusing to some degree that that's the only one where the fan feedback said, yeah, her skin cap looked terrible. What's going on with that? So he would not specify which. I don't know if it was the one you noticed or not.
Yeah, this was very brief. So it's like shaving your head for a 5-second walk-on is a big move. But maybe she just, you know, chooses to go bald. I was bald for years. I thought bald would be the future, and then I grew my hair out. Okay, so weird thing. You know Babylon 5? It's basically shaped like a series of different size globule shapes, all stuck together and rotating. What I had never realized until this episode is that there's also a big old triangular docking module stuck on the side of that thing. And it's just always been, like, positioned behind the station in our various views we've had of it so far. But in the opening scene of this episode, it's right on top and forward to the camera. So we're zooming into the station, and I'm like, what is that big triangle ship that's stuck on the station? It's not a ship. It's part of the station. I just haven't noticed before. It's a big old forked docking bay module.
Mm-hmm.
But it makes sense, because you're rotating the station for artificial gravity. You don't want to rotate the docking module, because people have to, like, you know, fly straight onto that thing.
Yeah, it's... I wish I could remember the term, but they actually found a concept for a space station that said, here is how you make it work, and they use that. So this is based on actual science, and that informed the design.
I like it.
The series actually started winning awards in the first season for having some of the more accurate science for television science fiction.
Very good. Very good. It was nice to see Natoth get some focus as someone other than just Jakar's aide.
Yes. Yeah, knowing that she has the Shankar and finding out more of her backstory helps to flesh her out. And seeing her reaction and seeing Jakar's reaction, where he says, okay, I know that your blood is teeming with the Shankar blood oath. I have a few of them myself. You know, you can't give it up. You wouldn't be Narn if you did. But let's use her, get what we want from her first, and then I'll help you finish this blood oath.
Mm-hmm. And Jakar continued to present himself as not the bad guy on this show. And there was actually a really cool bit of mutual respect shown between him and Sinclair at the end of their meeting regarding Natal's behavior. There was, like, not a handshake, but, like, another species' cultural equivalent.
Yeah, and Jakar stepping up and apologizing, and we realized then he was playing it to defuse the situation to make contact with Deathwalker later.
Right.
As a means to apologize. But he does, you know, he suggests to release her, and he would take care of her. And Sinclair says, no, but I'll agree to house arrest in your quarters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the ulterior motives don't surprise me at all. But it was still cool to see, like, the deep moment between them.
Yeah. And this is Babylon 5. Pretty much everyone has ulterior motives of one kind or another.
Yes. Even I do. I'm sure you do. Let's see. Oh, okay. So, as we said earlier, Jadur, is that Deathwalker's name?
Yes, Jadur.
Jadur is played by Sarah Douglas. But when we first get a look at her face, my reaction was, oh, hey, I just saw her on Seinfeld. Because I've been watching the first seasons of Seinfeld along with my Superman read-through, which is positioned just a handful of years before this. So in a second season episode in 1991, the first episode was called The Ex-Girlfriend. And Tracy Colas guest stars in that. And, you know, she plays this attractive but somewhat obnoxious ex-girlfriend character. And just the way her eyes and facial structure... The first time we see Sarah Douglas in the makeup, she looks like Tracy Colas might look if she had the same makeup. So, I don't know, just my reaction on that, I was like, oh, I know this actress. And it was only by looking her up that I realized, oh no, that's Sarah Douglas under there.
Yeah, so you're right that you knew her.
I was. So, when Sinclair has the conversation with Admiral, is it Hidoshi?
Yes, Admiral Hidoshi.
Admiral Hidoshi. It felt slightly sketchy, kind of like the conversation between Marty McFly and Needles in Back to the Future 2. Not that sketchy, but, you know, kind of that same flavor. But then after you've seen the episode once, you know, that everybody wants their hands on J'adore, and you watch it again, you're like, definitely sketchy. That Admiral is definitely, totally lying to Sinclair's face the entire time.
Oh, yeah. He knows her under her pseudonym that she's using. He's demanding that she be sent to Earth immediately. So clearly the Admiral knows about the immortality serum, and he's trying to get the Earth Alliance hands on her for that as well.
And the way that scene is positioned in this plot structure, the Narns and the Earth government both want the woman, and they want to transport her discreetly off the station to their own custody. Something is definitely up.
Oh, yeah, especially when the Admiral ends the conversation by saying, this is on a need-to-know basis, and you do not need to know.
Right.
So he's blatantly saying, I'm not telling you everything, and I'm not gonna.
So Sinclair is talking to J'adore, and she just casually throws out the, you know, they say you have a hole in your mind phrase. And of course, at this point, that phrase is like, perk the ears up, important plot point, here we go. We had heard that character from The Gathering referred to as a member of one of the warrior castes of the Minbari. And here, the Windswords are described as one of the Minbari's premier warrior castes. And it's not explicitly stated, yes, the person who said that you had a hole in your mind was a member of the Windswords. But it seems like that is the most logical connection that we are meant to draw as the reader, as the watchers of the show.
That is correct, yes. That Minbari that we saw in The Gathering was a member of the Windswords.
Okay. I connected the dots in the correct numerical order. I feel accomplished.
Mm-hmm. And this is also why the vote with the League of Non-Aligned Worlds went the way it did, to prevent the immediate sentencing to trial for Deathwalker, is because the Minbari government was not immediately aware that the Windswords were sheltering J'adore, but became aware during the Earth-Minbari War and didn't want to reveal that.
Mm.
So this is why the Minbari voted against it. In a nice moment for Lanier.
Yes.
This is one where Delenn's off station and they don't explain why, but it's one of those cases where in this first season, the ambassadors were contracted for anywhere from 8 to 11 appearances, as were their attachés. So sometimes it's the attaché that's available if the ambassador is in a lot of other episodes. So yeah, this is a case where they used Lanier and not Delenn, because Mira Furlan's presence was more important elsewhere. And I think it worked nicely, because maybe it's because I know what kind of character Lanier is in greater detail, because I've seen the whole series. First time through, it's probably establishing the kind of person he is. But when Sinclair is trying to find out if J'adore was actually being held by the Windswords, he trusted Lanier enough to say, this is the situation, can you look into it? Meanwhile, when Londo comes up and says, hey, is Deathwalker on the station? It's, you shouldn't listen to rumors. So he definitely has different levels of trust for Lanier and Londo. So it's just a bit more of a gut punch when Lanier votes no.
Yeah, it really was. But you're right that it's a good moment for him. Of course, we've seen several episodes with Delenn without Lanier. So knowing that that episode count restriction is there, it was really cool to see him step up and be a person on the show, possibly really for the first time. We've seen him only once before, but only in the context of Delenn's assistance. And here he gets to be his own professional.
Yes, or apparently he was ad-libbing in that first appearance and had the whole crew in stitches, because, you know, when they're walking away and Delenn says, tell me about Homeworld, they knew that was going to be the end of the shot. So he was just ad-libbing things like, well, Beatlemania is back, that he knew were never going to be in the finished product. So it seems like Bill Mumy is the kind of guy you want to have on set. He keeps the tensions down and things light.
Okay, so with Kosh having been a mystery for so long, I was really not sure how to feel about him, A, having an actual plot, yay, for the first time, but then it being so seemingly nonsensical, playing off a sort of farcical comedy character, and we'll get to the reveal at the end of all of that, but just the way it played, and I'm not sure that the the performance by getting her name up here, because I don't know these actors' names for some reason. But the telepath...
Andrea Thompson.
I'm not sure that her performance was really as strong in this episode as I would have liked it to be. I know that so much of what she had to do was be annoyed and have mental pain with her hand to her forehead. But I don't know. I was not enthused by that series of events, because it seemed, and it was intended probably to seem nonsensical for most of the time. So that was not my favorite part of the episode. Then at the end, you would find out, oh, he is actually just capturing your emotional reactions on record for nefarious, sinister purposes that we don't know. And I'm like, okay, that's a portent for the future. I have no idea what it is, but it certainly makes Kosh seem a lot more suspect than he has been heretofore.
Okay. Yeah, that is one of the two things for Kosh. One of them is really subtle, but we'll get to it in giving form to the dream.
But yeah.
Just wondering if you picked up on the other one.
Not sure. I know that he wasn't present at the vote, but it seemed that his main reason for being absent from the vote was to be present for the attack at the end.
Yeah, for that, he had no intention of participating in the discussion. He just needed to know the results.
Right.
Because he had made the decision, these guys are not getting the immortality serum. And it was just, you know, if they take care of it on their own, fine. If not, we'll clean up.
Was I wrong in thinking that Dr. Franklin was a civilian? Because he's in uniform in this episode, and it struck me as odd.
Yeah, this is something they haven't really specified it on screen, but JMS talks about it in the Usenet posts that are summarized in the Asked and Answered. This is an Earth Force station, so you must be a member of Earth Force to be there, but people like Dr. Franklin and previously Dr. Kyle could, because of their skill set and the challenges of finding someone with that skill set, they could just take a commission. So he could just be a low-ranked non-commissioned officer or, you know, a low-ranked commission officer as almost like a rubber stamp so that they could hire him to do this job.
Okay.
So he is a member of the military, but he's got minimal training and has no intention of ever firing a weapon at anyone.
Right. Okay. That makes sense. I liked that line from Garibaldi when he's talking to Sinclair. He says, "You better pray to that god of yours, blah, 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 blah." And I was like, okay, this sounds like the result of previous conversations between these two characters on their beliefs in the supernatural or metaphysical or whatever. And there's like, it's just a line, but it sounds like we have established as friends for however many years, you believe in a god, I do not. We've talked about this. We're a little bit at odds, but friendly over it. So you know what? Pray to that god of yours that this works out okay. It felt really genuine is what I'm saying.
Yeah, and it's also nice, as was established in Parliament of Dreams, to see that in the Babylon 5 universe, a variety of religions persist.
Mm-hmm.
As they have during human history. So that is just part of the texture of the universe. This establishes, for the viewer as well, Garibaldi is an atheist, and Sinclair is not.
And he's not an atheist in the sense that he still values all different belief systems, because Sinclair is the person who chose to bring the 20 or 30 or 40 or however many representatives of the different cultural faiths to the station. And it's one of those things about science fiction, we may have talked about this on the on that episode, but like so many alien races in science fiction are presented monolithically. We occasionally get chances to see that there's more complexity to, say, the Klingons or the Romulans than we have seen in most of their appearances. But generally speaking, when you see a member of an alien race, you box them in your brain because you know the characteristics of that alien race, when really there should not, in reality, be that such a monolithic existence. So to see that humans, at least, still have their infinite diversity and infinite combinations going on was pretty cool.
Yeah, and a lot of the other series, the alien races are really one aspect of the human experience dialed up to 11
mm-hmm.
to reflect that part of it. Whereas in this one of the things I like about Babylon 5 that we will see a lot more of as the series progresses is that these races feel a lot more developed and a lot more individual. They you actually believe, no, there is a complete race back there, right? There's a lot more that they could do. So they just feel more fully realized.
Yeah. More fully realized, more developed, more complex. And it is in the, especially with the alien species that feature among the main cast, we get to see a lot more going on there. Ambassador Kalika, she is not the same Abai ambassador that we saw in the War Prayer, although the costuming appears identical or close to it. I was pleasantly surprised to see the return of this alien design that, you know, was so visually memorable from the War Prayer, but then not to have the same actress. I was like, oh, okay. Of course, they got Robin Curtis. I think, not to belittle the actress whom we only saw for maybe a total of 30 seconds before, but I thought Robin Curtis did a fantastic job presenting a very assertive leadership role among this, not only among her people, but among the non-aligned worlds as a collection, and possibly more than my impression of the previous actress would have done.
I did find that the appearance here was a lot more assertive and a lot more of a leadership. I don't know how much of that is on the actress level and how much of it is on the script level.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree that there is a definite difference in the presentation of that species here. So should we move on to Last Best Hope, or do you have more for Legan's session with the general discussion before we go on to the standout character moments?
One or two other thoughts. Minor things. Oh, yeah. There's the moment where the non-aligned worlds pull out of the whole Babylon 5 thing. And I feel like it's one of those side effects of the fact that season one is pretty much episodic, separate one-part plots. But in a more ongoing narrative of cultural developments in history and a story, I feel like that total breakdown of the Babylon 5 setup should have had more weight and more impact, and maybe could have been in and of itself a cliffhanger moment in a multi-part, two-part storyline. Like, this is it. We can't resolve this over this really major issue. Babylon 5 is over. Non-aligned worlds are pulling out.
I see what you're saying, and for me, it's, you're right, that should be huge and it should have more impact. I see why it was handled this way as part of one episode, because having seen the entire series, it's not the major impacts we're going to see down the road. That feels huge, but the scope and scale of the series is going to expand so much, even by the end of this season.
Just at the level we're at now, like, that could have been bigger. But like I said, it's, they've got one episode to tell this story. They may have had a commercial break there, I don't know, before coming back to find a resolution and go forward.
That should have been like a 9 or 10 on the intensity scale, but you find it on this series, the dial doesn't stop at 10. It goes up to like 90 or 100.
And my last thing is a minor note, the Zocalo. There's a cool neon sign up there that has a very stylized lettering for Zocalo that almost doesn't look like letters unless you know what it's supposed to say. And you're like, oh, I can see how those are the letters. They just, it's really stylized. I thought it was a really cool design. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it was just a neat little prop to set it aside.
Yeah. But I just, if we had seen that before, I had not noticed it. And it's a very cool little bit.
Yeah, I don't know that we have seen it before. And the Zocalo, we said before, the main corridor, because of its size, is the only really standing set. So the Zocalo is one of the sets that gets sort of undressed and redressed. And it was designed, basically, this station should be modular, and they should have been able to put together generic pieces. So they designed their sets that way, so that they can, you know, shift a couple walls around, and then, you know, the council chambers becomes Sinclair's office, becomes this, becomes that. Pull a chunk out of the floor, and now you're in CNC for command and control in the, or the observation dome. So yeah, that's one of the props that they have to help distinguish it. So the dress is how you can tell where you are in the station for a lot of cases. And I think they do the job well, because watching it, I know from reading the books behind it that that's how it was built. They do it well enough on screen that I cannot say, oh, this set is that set. They just moved that wall over there.
Mm-hmm.
It's not obvious how they're designing it to do that. So they've done a really good job with it.
But that all being said, I thought this was a relatively strong re-entry for the episode run. Not like, you know, Sky Full of Stars, Blow Me Away episode, but just like, we're coming back. it was not a damp squib of an episode to come back on. A strong story with strong performances. I wasn't a fan of the B-plot, but the B-plot also doesn't take up a huge amount of screen time, so it doesn't lower my estimation of the episode too much.
Yeah, I would agree. This one, it works well. It helps flesh out, in particular, Na'Toth and more of the League of Non-Aligned Worlds. And we see that, yeah, this is not completely happy. And the position of Babylon 5 is tenuous, which goes back to those odds we heard about in The Gathering, where they said, yeah, you know, it didn't have, it had like 50-50 odds of surviving 6 months and things like that. So I think it does well to pull it together. It's engaging. As they say, this is not a moral show. There are some shows where when you come away, they say, we've discussed the ethics and this is the right answer. This is what they call the ethical show, where the characters struggle with it and they're not completely convinced that the choices they made are the right choices. And we really get that feel here, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see more of that next week, because that's what that whole thing is about. But more on that later.
Oh, okay. But yeah, that's all I have for the episode.
Okay, so your last best hope, what was the standout character or character moment for you?
I honestly can't even think of a way it could be anyone other than the guy with the brain head. No, just kidding. J'adore Sarah Douglas's performance as Deathwalker. And I mean, you want your guest stars to be kind of the standout of the episode, but that's not always the case. And this definitely, definitely was. She was interesting. Her performance was intriguing. It was complex. Things like her monument, you know, how this immortality system is going to be her monument. And at first it's like, oh, you just want to be famous after you die? That's so shallow. But then it's like, no, I want to see y'all scrabble over each other, killing each other to be immortal, because that's how I roll.
Yeah, I agree. This is a Hitler-level character is what was called for. And that's what she delivered.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Dottilio might be saying her performance is not what it could have been because of those contact lenses. Mm-hmm. If he hadn't made that statement, I never would have known that she had any issues with that makeup.
Right.
Because the performance is just there. So I'm really curious about that parallel universe where they didn't give her the contact lenses and we saw what she could really do. Because if this is below the standard of what she delivered in the auditions, man, those auditions must have been amazing.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I will agree with you that, yes, it's the performance of Sarah Douglas is the best element in this episode. So then we move on to giving form to the dream and pulling out bits and pieces of this episode that will be relevant in future episodes. Some directly, some indirectly.
The only thing I saw was the thing I mentioned earlier.
Okay. Yeah, I've seen a couple. So some, we've established that the Shankar blood oath is part of the Narn culture, and Shakar has several. So that is something that's going to return.
So world building, cultural development, and specifically Shakar's ties to that concept.
Yeah. Now, we have also established here that, Kosh has something with Natalia to find her greatest fears, her dreams. And we know that what he pulled from her greatest fears, remind her of the thoughts that she felt when she had to scan a serial killer about 4 years prior. But this was not the serial killer's thoughts.
Okay, so that whole thing, I was really not sure how to read it. Because she keeps seeing this series of images, and it eventually leads to her, you know, being attacked by this, you know, person. And then she explains that she one time scanned a serial killer's mind. So I didn't know if she was like flashing back to memories of that encounter. So you're suggesting that her contact with Kosh's mind was similar in nature in some way that we don't know to her contact with that serial killer's mind.
It wasn't so much Kosh's mind. It was the vicar there who was bringing out her worst fears and her worst hopes.
Okay.
So Kosh was just talking to keep the conversation going so that the vicar could draw that out from her. But specifically when she felt these emotions that she felt when she scanned the serial killer, the images that we see, Talia is in a relatively dark area, but she is seeing lights. She's seeing, at some points, it looks like equipment around her. And at other points, there's reflections of her. So there's more than one image of her.
Okay.
So there are ways to interpret that image that will become much more clear down the road.
Interesting. All right, so all of that has a lot more ramification than I thought it did. Still didn't love the storytelling, but at least I know that there's some stuff to come out of it.
Yeah, it's one that I get more out of on the second viewing.
Yeah.
Or the second viewing of the series, rather than the second viewing of the episode.
And it's easier to forgive stuff like that, that it's hard to take the first time around, knowing that something at least is setting up more important stuff later. It's easier to say, okay, well, this isn't great, but it's important.
Yeah, you see the utility.
Right.
Even if the delivery doesn't quite do what you hoped it would.
Yeah.
The other elements, these immortality serums are possible. And when the Vorlons destroyed the craft with Jadur and Deathwalker, when Kosh explained it, he said, "You are not ready for immortality." He did not say, "We are not ready for immortality."
That did seem to come from a position of authority and perspective. Yeah, I caught that.
Right. So, yeah, those are the bits and pieces.
Interesting.
Okay. So from there, should we tell people what to prepare for next week?
Yeah. So next week is going to be Believers, which I don't know anything about. So
this is one. I don't want to get into plots because I don't like spoilers to the point that, you know, if I know I'm going to watch a movie, I don't even watch the trailers for that movie. I like to go in as blind as possible. What I will say is that coming up, we have an episode written by David Gerald and directed by Richard Compton, which is a nice spotlight for Dr. Franklin.
Gotcha. I like David Gerald. I want to be David Gerald's friend. Like, I've seen him online, and I just have a lot of respect for the guy.
Yeah, I do too. And I've seen a lot of stuff because the person I did not name before who's got, you know, friends who worked in the Florida TV stations, mm-hmm. He legitimately is David Gerald's friend.
Ah.
So I've had some sort of secondary interaction when we both interact with that mutual friend. And yeah, David Gerald does seem like a pretty great guy.
Weirdly, David Gerald and Jerry Conway occupy very adjacent spaces in my brain. Like, as soon as I had to, like, remember which one is which and who did what, because I don't know, they're right next to each other in my brain. But that's a whole other conversation.
Okay. How does Jeff Conaway fit into that?
Jeff. I don't know.
Okay. Well, perhaps we'll find out someday. All right. So, listeners, hopefully we had feedback to have a feedback episode last week. We'll know for sure when, you know, people can actually hear these episodes, because we're recording this in 2022. But for the next feedback episode, you are welcome and encouraged to be a participant. One way to do that is to send an email to babylon530yearslater@gmail.com.
Another way is to send us comments. You can go to either of the two websites where this show is hosted. One of those is my own podcast website, johnreadscomics.com. There is no H in .com. And that's where all of my previous and current podcasting efforts are posted. And go to the posting for this particular episode and leave us a comment. We will read it and respond to it on the air.
Yes, and just to clarify, that is John and not Jean. So there's no apostrophe and just one N. So you can also leave comments at bureau42.com, which is where all the podcasts I'm involved with can be found.
And then you can also leave us reviews at your favorite podcatcher, whatever that may be. We check Apple Podcasts for reviews, but if you happen to leave a review somewhere else, just let us know. If you would like us to read it on the air, we'll be happy to do so, and thank you.
And if you are following this podcast on YouTube, you can also leave comments on the episodes there.
All right. So hopefully we'll get lots and lots of feedback, because we like to hear your thoughts, and I've always enjoyed, in my podcasting endeavors, interacting with the listeners. That's one of the things that makes it feel worthwhile.
Yeah, we want this to be a conversation. That's part of the reason we're doing it this way. I previously did a podcast about the X-Files, which was a purely solo effort. So I went through every episode of the X-Files. And quite frankly, creatively, that was my least satisfying podcast of all the 20-some different podcasts I have done. It's the kind of thing that doesn't gel without another body.
Mm.
And I've enjoyed working with John in the past. We've had good conversations before. So this podcast started when I reached out to John and say, "Hey, do you want to do a podcast and knowing his love for Superman, I suggested a Super Friends podcast. And John said, I like the idea of podcasting together, but how about this instead?
Yes. My love for Superman somehow does not give me a strong love for Super Friends. No offense to all of you 70s and 80s babies out there. Like what you like. I watched the entire series and probably will never do so again.
Yeah, although we have been talking about what may follow a Babylon 5 podcast, so stay tuned for that.
In 5 years.
Just in case you question how much planning we do. We may not be JMS level for planning, but there's planning.
There is planning.
We might even know what we're doing after this. So, that's where we're at. Thank you for listening.
And good eating to you.